This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
Cameroon is deploying more troops to protect the Lobeke National Park on its border with the Central African Republic after a deadly attack earlier this month by armed poachers. The attackers fled back across the border into the CAR, leaving behind carcasses of protected animals and tusks from at least 20 elephants.
That's Moki Edwin Kenzeka reporting from Yaoundé. Details coming up.
Also, dozens of extremist militants attacked a Northern Army barracks today in a town in Burkina Faso, killing at least 12 soldiers. And Nigeria and Cameroon have completely reopened their borders for the first time in 3 years.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, Burkina Faso authorities say about 40 militants attacked a Northern Army barracks today, killing at least 11 soldiers. Two soldiers are reported missing. The attack occurred in the town of Nasungu on the border with Mali, about 260 kilometers from the capital, Ouagadougou. AP reports the attackers also set fire to tents and military vehicles. Meanwhile, AFP reports authorities say the jihadists used pickup trucks and motorbikes to launch the attack and were armed with AK-47s and rocket launchers. They reportedly were waving black flags. Militants have launched several attacks in Burkina Faso this year. The troops that came under attack are part of a 600-strong anti-terrorist battalion stationed in the region. President Kabore was scheduled to travel to Nigeria to attend the ECOWAS meeting on the Gambia. However, he has canceled his travel plans following the attack.
The border between Nigeria and Cameroon has been completely reopened for the first time in 3 years. It's a key sign of progress in the war against Boko Haram. Moki Edwin Kenzeka has more from Yaoundé, where officials from the two countries met this week to review security issues.
This military band is welcoming delegates from Nigeria and Cameroon, gathering to discuss Boko Haram. Officials here say the threat of terrorist attacks has been greatly reduced due to joint cross-border military raids targeting the Islamist militant group. They say that the border between Cameroon and Nigeria is now completely reopened, a process that began last month. General Abba Mohammed Diko is head of the Nigerian delegation.
Only a secured environment can provide avenue for meaningful trade and commercial activities, as well as unimpeded exchange of goods and services. The unflinching cooperation and support of Cameroon has indeed curtailed the menace of the Boko Haram sect in all its ramifications. Success against Boko Haram will end movement of refugees across boundaries and create the enabling environment for the return and repatriation of internally displaced persons back to their ancestral land.
The Boko Haram insurgency began in northeastern Nigeria in 2009, eventually spreading to neighboring Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. The conflict has displaced 2.7 million people, according to the UN. At least 20,000 people have died in the violence. But an end to the conflict, while welcome, will present fresh issues, said historian and member of the Cameroon delegation, Professor Saibu Issa.
We know today that thousands of people, especially of young men from Cameroon, from Nigeria, from Chad, joined Boko Haram. And as progressively Boko Haram attacks are diminishing, it is maybe time to think about how the states are going to cope with these young people. There is the challenge of managing the vigilante groups, who are contributing a lot fighting against Boko Haram.
Cameroon's northern border areas were hit hard by the insurgency, farming and trade ground to a halt, but the area is slowly returning to life, said the governor of the far north region of Cameroon, Midjiyawa Bakari.
We have been authorized by the head of state to reopen the border between Nigeria and Cameroon, and people are very happy. School have been reopened. We have trucks coming from Maiduguri to N'Djamena through Fotokol Cameroon and from Cameroon to Nigeria, and also the cows.
Security concerns remain, with both countries warning about Boko Haram's continued use of female suicide bombers, described by officials here as the last lashes of a dying monster. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
In related news, international aid agencies are asking for more than $240 million to help a half million Nigerian refugees displaced by the Boko Haram insurgency. The money would be used to help those in Niger, Chad, and Cameroon over the next year. The request by UN agencies and others is $43 million higher than this year's appeal, which is less than half funded.
Also, Yahias, the ongoing investigation into last weekend's fatal church collapse in Nigeria has found the building had numerous structural faults. The AP reports that authorities had issued repeated orders to halt construction of the building. At least 160 people were reported killed December 10th when the roof collapsed, although the official government death toll stands at 27. The Rainers Bible Church was being built in the southern city of Uyo in Akwa Ibom State. Hundreds of people were in the building for a ceremony to welcome the founder, Alan Weeks, as a bishop. The Council for the Regulation of Engineering says construction had been going on for about 3 years without any permits. The head of the council says any engineers working on the church should surrender to authorities.
So far, there is no breakthrough on the political impasse in the Gambia, where President Yahya Jammeh accepted but then rejected the victory of challenger Adama Barrow in recently held presidential elections. A high-powered ECOWAS delegation went to Banjul this week but failed to resolve the standoff. It will meet again tomorrow. Sadi Gassam is the director of Amnesty International Senegal branch. VOA reporter Alpha Jallo asked him whether he is surprised by President Jammeh's behavior.
So I'm not surprised, but I think that it's totally unacceptable. The will of the Gambian people should be respected. This is a basic human rights of the Gambian people to choose through free and fair elections their own leaders. So we really hope that the efforts made by the African Union, by ECOWAS, by the UN, all the international pressure on Jammeh will isolate him in the international community and will at last push him to accept the results that have been published by the Commission, which all the observers present in the Gambia, the members of the African Union, of the ECOWAS Parliament, have agreed that it was fair and that these results reflect the will of the Gambian people.
We understood that a high-powered ECOWAS delegation have met with President Jammeh to persuade him to relinquish power, but there are no tangible results so far. What do you think is the next step?
This commission, after this high-level mission of ECOWAS, head of state are going to meet Saturday to discuss the outcome of the mission. The African Union Commission also have recommended the African Union to send a high-level mission to the Gambia, led by its president Idriss Déby, with representatives from each of the African regions. We hope that the decision that will be made during the summit on Saturday, coupled with the mission that the AU may be sending in the next weeks to the Gambia, will persuade Jammeh to relinquish power. I think it's better for him, it's better for the people of the Gambia, it's better for Africa.
Do you think that Senegal and Nigeria can exert some pressure on Jammeh to cede power to President-elect Barrow?
I think that every country in the world, especially countries in West Africa should exert every influence and every pressure that they can on Jammeh and his clique to relinquish power. We far prefer to get the result, which is smooth transfer of power to the president-elect through pressure, through dialogue, than through the use of force.
In case President Jammeh blatantly refused to step aside until the transition period expires, do you think the ECOWAS and the African Union can resort to draconian measures of removing him?
It's about credibility for the African Union, for ECOWAS, for the international community, to make sure that the president-elect take office and run the country. It's a big challenge for them, and I think that every means should be used and fought as a last resort, because it's an option. It's not Seydi Gassama saying that. It's an option for ECOWAS. And they clearly say it through the statement of the ECOWAS Commission chairperson, that force is not excluded in order to make sure that the new president take office. Indeed, force means killing innocent people during the fight. So it's not what we wish for the Gambian people. But as I said, if Jammeh does not give people any other option, then force may be used to remove them.
That was the director of the Senegal branch of Amnesty International, Saeed Gassama. He was speaking to reporter Alpha Jallo.
Coming up on 17 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Africa's oldest head of state, President Robert Mugabe, says he has no immediate plans to step down. In fact, today the Zimbabwean leader said he was not happy with some members of his ruling ZANU-PF party who were calling for him to resign. Sebastian Mofu has more from Mashingo.
Speaking at the official opening of the ZANU-PF annual conference in Mashingo, about 300 kilometers south of Harare, the 92-year-old leader urged his party to unite as Zimbabwe heads toward its next elections in 2018. His party has two factions angling to succeed the Zimbabwean leader. Mugabe accused the factions of using social media to attack each other, saying, quote, "We must not settle our issues through Facebook and Twitter," unquote.
There has been creeping into our party a new culture of indiscipline, and there is even contempt and arrogance.
In the Shona language, he says, "There are some who say they no longer like Mugabe. To them, he asks, what do you want done?" It is almost taboo in ZANU-PF to discuss who will replace Mugabe, who has been at the helm of Zimbabwe since it won independence from Great Britain in 1980. But with Zimbabwe's collapsed economy showing no signs of life, and with the president set to turn 93 in February, such talk has begun, even though the president is choosing not to hear. For VOA News, Sebastian Mofu in Mashingo, Zimbabwe.
And you're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580, and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, and at 19 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Dozens of extremist militants attacked a Northern Army barracks today in a town in Burkina Faso, killing at least 12 soldiers. Nigeria and Cameroon have completely reopened their border for the first time in 3 years. And still, no breakthrough on the political impasse in the Gambia, where President Yahya Jammeh has rejected the victory of challenger Adama Barrow. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
So Zimbabwe's second largest city is Bulawayo, a former industrial center that churns out hundreds of college graduates each year. But in the nation's declining economy, most of them can't find jobs. Many cross the border to look for work in South Africa. Reporter Kuzayi Svinavashi talked to the parents of these graduates about the sad realities they face when they leave home.
Bulawayo was once a bustling industrial town, but today it is a ghost town with deserted manufacturing plants. The town also houses two universities and multiple colleges. The schools did not close and continue to produce graduates who can get jobs. Takura Sibanda, a father of two, says he thought he had achieved his dream when his children graduated. Then the children relocated to South Africa, where the situation is not as bright as most people in Zimbabwe imagine it to be.
My children's life. I took them to school for a good education. You know, they all have degrees. One of them finished a few years back. But now, because of the current situation of Zimbabwe, they cannot find jobs.
It's a case of being caught between a rock and a hard place. To make ends meet, the jobless graduates often have to make tough decisions. Sibanda says his children now work in the neighboring South Africa, but not in the kinds of work they were trained to do.
My children have resorted to going to South Africa to find jobs. But now, whilst they are there in South Africa, they are working odd jobs. They don't have proper jobs. And it's difficult in a foreign nation for you to get a proper job and be recognized as somebody who is doing proper work.
Wangani Dube is a graduate who relocated and works in South Africa. He explains what pushed him to join 1,000 others that have crossed the border in search for greener pastures. He uses popular nicknames for the names of the country he is from and one way he has found work.
The economic hardships in Zim has inspired most of us to move right across the border and try and find greener pasture. There are no jobs in Zim, you understand? As a graduate like myself and others in a familiar position. So coming to SA and trying to work in SA, it's far much better than staying in Zim.
Sibanda says his children went to South Africa in search for greener pastures.
I had expected for a better future for them. Even if they're in South Africa, it's difficult for them to really be rooted. Pastures aren't exactly green, but it's better. It's not dry.
Locals in South Africa have not taken lightly to foreigners taking their jobs. Xenophobic attacks that have erupted in the country have often been about frustrated South Africans, arguing that foreigners are taking their jobs. Working conditions are not favorable for most Zimbabweans because they need work permits to apply for proper work. Wangani says there is discrimination.
Discrimination is one of the challenges we're facing in South Africa, say, where we are discriminated on all levels because we are from Zim. And there is that notion that Zimbabwean people are intelligent and South African people don't take that well.
The South African government, like governments in many countries, make sure the good job opportunities are taken by their citizens before foreigners get a chance. Hence, a work permit is what keeps an educated Zimbabwean from applying for a good job. Dube says it is hard to get a work permit in South Africa.
We're given jobs that won't even be taken in Zim because those are jobs that are not for people who are trained like us, understand? You find a lawyer, you find a teacher working in a restaurant, so painful. And then we find that most Zimbabweans do not have proper papers, and then those papers are the ones that enable you to get proper jobs. And it is very difficult for a Zimbabwean to get a study or a worker's permit.
With very little jobs to get by in Zimbabwe, graduates have had to innovate, immigrate, or stay unemployed. Nkebisi Ngwenya, who recently graduated at NUST, Bulawayo's biggest university, says he is one of the few that turned to entrepreneurship.
The advantage that I've had, I mean, as a student was that I was studying entrepreneurship but doing it externally and getting mentorship from other people. So I took the knowledge that I had from that entrepreneurship to use my knowledge from university to start my own business immediately after graduating.
Ngwenya says he wishes he could say the same for other students but cannot.
They are not like me, they didn't have the same knowledge that I had of entrepreneurship. So, to be honest, they're seated.
Despite being home to multiple tertiary institutions and producing graduates into unemployment, the government of Zimbabwe is saying it is working on reviving the economy, which may see the unemployment rate decreasing. Only time can tell, as this has been the Zimbabwean government's message for the past decade. This is Kudzai Nawashe, reporting for Voice of America from Harare. Yeah.
arson is suspected in a fire at a migrant worker's shelter in a western Paris suburb that killed one person today and injured several others. Eyewitnesses say the victim, a Malayan man in his 40s, jumped to his death from the third floor. He had arrived at the shelter just 4 days ago. AFP reports authorities say the cause of the fire appears to be criminal in nature. It damaged an entrance area and a storage room. Traces of fuel and lighter fluid were found at the scene.
The Malawi government and UNICEF will test the use of unmanned aircraft or drones for humanitarian operations. They've established an air corridor over Malawi, the first in Africa and one of the first globally with a focus on humanitarian and development use. Lamek Messina reports from Lilongwe.
Government authorities say the air corridor is designed to provide a controlled platform so the drones can deliver needed services to communities. Alfred Ntilatila is the director for the Department of Civil Aviation.
We would like to establish a designated area where we would permit the testing of the different types of unmanned aerial vehicles so that we should be able to come up with the right type of vehicles which can be used for different types.
He says the launch of the testing corridor largely supports a pilot project by UNICEF Malawi on the feasibility of using UAS for transporting dried blood samples for the early diagnosis of HIV in infants. In March this year, UNICEF successfully completed its first test flight of the 10 kilometers route from a community health center to the referral Kamuzu Central Hospital laboratory in the capital, Lilongwe. Currently, Malawi uses motorbikes or locally run ambulances to transport blood samples. But health authorities say high fuel costs and the poor state of roads has meant long delays in deliveries. A recent study by UNICEF Malawi shows that it currently takes an average of 11 days to get the samples from a health center to a testing lab and up to 4 weeks for the results to finally be retained. It says the delay between tests and results have resulted in a high number of patients who do not receive timely treatment. Judith Sherman is the chief of HIV and AIDS section at UNICEF Malawi. She told VOA that the drones project seeks to help resolve the problem.
So some of the health facilities are in very remote areas, and it takes a while for motorbikes to actually reach those facilities. And during the rainy season, and the roads are difficult to go on, and bridges get washed away. So the idea was, can UAVs or drones be introduced to help complement the motorbike system?
The corridor will run for a maximum distance of 40 kilometers and become fully operational by April 2017 after their second test flight. Lamek Masina for VOA from Lilongwe.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Wojtek Zorniak, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
VOA News.
When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.